Please take your seats.
Welcome to meeting 197. This is March. I'm not sure what the word is before penultimate. Next month will be penultimate. This is the penultimate meeting of this year's Faculty Senate. If you're all ready, Jane, would you take the roll?
If I start coughing, I'm on the tail end of a cold, so I apologize. Abramovich.
Present.
Albertson.
Present.
Baker. Tory Baker. Barnes. Bill Barnes. Berge. Yeah. Bret Hart. C. Anyone here for Vincent C? Chen. Anyone here for Chen Fu Chen? Kaufman.
Present.
Condi.
Yep.
Cook.
Here.
Davis.
Here.
Dean. John Dean. Duke.
I'm here on the phone.
Thank you. Fallon.
Here.
Focesato. Gibson.
Here.
Gustafson.
Here.
Hahn.
Here.
Hardy. Healy. Joanne Healy. She may be calling in. Horseman.
Yep.
Johnson.
Here.
Johnston.
Here.
Jolly. Healand.
Here, replacing Falkutman.
Okay, Falk is here for Knut. Larden.
Here.
Lovecraft.
Present.
McCartney.
Here.
Meyer. He's traveling. Misra.
Here.
Moser.
Here.
Newberry.
Here.
Radenbaugh.
On the telephone.
Thank you. Shawcross.
Here, on the phone as well.
Thank you. Short.
Here.
Valentine.
Here.
Weber.
Here.
Webley.
Here.
Winfrey.
Here.
Windsor. Anyone here for Peter Windsor? Yari.
Here.
Zhang. Okay, Rorick is here for Zhang. And acknowledging we have our registrar, Libby Eddy.
Here.
I thought I saw you. Yep. Anyone here for staff counsel?
Here.
Brad is here. ASUS, anyone here for ASUAS? Athletics? Don't see anybody. Dean Herman is here for school management. Chancellor, I guess, is on his way. Our provost is here. And we have our vice provost, Alex Fitt. There's Eric Madsen. I know he'll be filling in for Franz Meyer today.
Thank you, Jane. Next is the approval of minutes from the last meeting. I would only highlight one thing that I noticed, which was that there was something about the size of the budget that university would be trying to close this year. And I said it, at the time it was $11 million. That figure was a little bit low. The figure that's actually being shot for is in the neighborhood of $14 to $15 million. So I've asked that to be amended to reflect that. Are there any other changes or concerns about the minutes from last meeting? If none, let's see. Shall I assume they're adopted? Move to adopt, somebody? Okay, thank you. Second, okay. All in favor? Aye. Any opposed? Okay, that's terrible. The next is the adoption of the agenda for today. Any additions that anyone has for today's agenda? Okay, seeing none, we'll use this agenda. Motions that we have passed out of the Senate as of last time all have been approved by the Chancellor. There are none pending before the Chancellor. And at this point, we move on to my remarks. I will keep them brief because we have a fairly full schedule today. The first is that we've been made aware that some Senate seats in some units are still open. This is, of course, a problem because we need a full and vibrant Senate next year. And so Cecile and I have drafted a memo that has been sent to the units, but we would ask that you, as you return to your units, that you help us beat the bushes for people who would be good senators to serve next year, and failing that, just senators. It would be good if we could get those, particularly in, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jane, but I think it was College of Natural Sciences and Mathematics, Engineering, and the School of Fish. Is that correct? Were the ones that were. If you identify as one of those, or if you know people that are in one of those, please, please help us find good candidates to run for next year. My second announcement is that it's just a reminder that the we are looking for nominees for the Outstanding Faculty Senator of the Year Award. Cecile Larden is heading that up, and maybe I'll let you actually expound on that if you want to, Cecile, when your remarks come around. Okay. All right. Well, this is just your opportunity to recognize colleagues, people in your committee chair, who have put in a lot of energy and been very productive this year that we may not know about. So we'd encourage you to submit those names to Cecile for consideration. My last comment is something that came from Faculty Alliance. Some of you may be aware that there was recently formed a summit team that consists of the president, the three chancellors, and the three provosts of the three universities. Faculty Alliance has communicated with the summit team to essentially advocate for ensuring an early and active faculty voice within the summit team. And there has been a productive exchange of communications about that that I think is important for you to know about. And I'll just sort of leave it at that for now. And we'll move on to the President-elect's remarks.
I'm going to keep it super short because we really do have a full agenda. Last year, the Senate initiated two ad hoc committees, one on joint appointments and the other on interdisciplinary collaboration. We now have reports from both of those committees, which is fantastic. And in fact, you will hear a presentation by Gary Kafinas, who chaired the interdisciplinary committee today. And both committees, you know, did some very thoughtful work, and I think will be good information, good starting point for discussion in the Senate and for various pieces of work that we're moving into. So today is going to be the start of that feedback process.
Thanks. The Chancellor's not here yet, so we'll move to Provost's remarks if you're ready, Susan.
Sure. First, a quick update on events at the Board of Regents meeting. The Masters of Music was approved, and that replaces the Masters of Arts in Music, which was deleted. We also had approval of the merger of the School of Natural Resources and Agricultural Sciences and the Cooperative Extension Service to form the unit, the School of Natural Resources and Extension. Another action of the board was to approve the statewide science plan, and this is a plan that's required by the infrastructure building program EBSCOR, and also a good thing to have in general. It is a requirement of some legislation that the state passed several years ago, And that plan was led by Dana Thomas and Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, and in particular by Mark Myers, our Vice Chancellor for Research, but had participation statewide from all three universities. I think it's still undergoing some final editing for printing, but once the final version is available, I'll make sure that that's linked to the Senate website so that people can find it conveniently. It's pretty interesting to see what's going on in research and what the large group that participated in developing this plan sees as some important directions that research in the state can take. The committee that participated in drafting this plan contained many representatives from government and industry around the state, not just university people. So their perspectives are perhaps a little bit different than what we would see if we only talked among ourselves. The other thing that I want to mention briefly is the budget process that is going on here within the University of Alaska Fairbanks. As most of you are aware, through the communication sent out by the Chancellor, the Budget Options Group spent some time early this year identifying ways in which we might meet the budget gap between the amount of state revenue that we have been getting in the past and the amount that we're likely to get for FY15, which will be less. That group has concluded its work and sent its report to the Planning and Budget Committee, which is the usual widely representative committee that I have each year, that I chair each year in conjunction with Pat Pitney, and that committee is charged in the usual run of events with evaluating increment requests for deciding what University of Alaska Fairbanks will put forward through the Board of Regents to the legislature to ask for additional funding. But this year, the Planning and Budget Committee has a broader mandate, and that will be to look at the options for spending less and or increasing our revenue and making some recommendations to the Chancellor's Cabinet. So that process is going to be ongoing for about the next 6 weeks. Some of the important elements of that process will be available to look at on the Office of Management and Budget website. In particular, the document that we're working from right now in the first week of our activities, the recommendations of the Budget Option Group, or they're not recommendations. I need to expunge that word from my vocabulary. They are simply the options that the Budget Options Group brought forward. Those are going to be available soon for the University Committee to look at. University community to look at. Gosh, I'm not speaking very clearly today. But anyway, so that concludes the remarks that I wanted to make. I'd be glad to answer any questions that people might have.
Any questions for the provost?
This is Mike Davis. Just to be clear on this, these options that the Budget Options Group came up with, you're saying that at some point you will then I didn't understand. These are options that are being presented as possible places for reductions, but I didn't understand what's the next process if faculty want to be involved in this. What?
Okay. The Budget Options Group documents that they prepared, which contain not only the options that they identified, but a good bit of information on exactly, well, or at least an estimate of how much funding would be saved, and also some statements of pros and cons for each possibility. That document is going to be available probably on the Office of Management and Budget website, although that's not fully determined yet, probably be available within about a week or so. And once that document is available, then there will be a pathway for people to provide input. There's already a pathway for people to provide input on potential options for either saving money or increasing revenue, and that is currently available through the Office of Management and Budget website. And people can feel free to continue to supply ideas through that avenue, even though the Budget Option Group has concluded its work. The Planning and Budget Committee is continuing to look for new ideas to add to our list of possibilities. So those are the avenues for input right now. There will be some additional ones, I'm sure, as we go forward, but I don't have those specifically to announce right now.
And I would add just a couple of things to that. On the Planning and Budget Committee, there is faculty representation, including Cecile Lardon and myself. While we were working on the budget options group, we did get faculty input that came in the form of emails and suggestions and so forth, and these were all taken to the budget options group for potential inclusion on the list. So that avenue is also open. Okay.
This budget option group report, is that also on a website that the Faculty Senate can take a look at?
The budget options group report isn't quite yet posted on the website, but I expect it to be within about a week. I think it will be on the Office of Management and Budget website, but I can certainly, once it is posted, send the link to Jane, and then she can make sure that senators know where to find it.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful. Thank you.
Debu.
Okay, so, quick question. Last semester, the chancellor was mentioning some vertical cuts. Is the budget options group recommendations include any of that at this point?
Well, it's a little bit out of context to talk about particular things that the budget options group put in their report. I think it would be best if people looked at the report as a whole, because among other things, it is very careful to present both the potential pros and potential cons of any particular cut. So it's not that they were advocating necessarily particular reductions, but rather they were analyzing them to make sure that my group, the Planning and Budget Committee, actually, I guess it's not my group in the possessive sense, but the group I participate in, the Planning and Budget Committee, would have the information that they needed to go forward.
But my follow-up question is, has the group looked into first, what was the priority? Was the revenue, increase of revenue the priority, or was cost saving the priority?
Well, both things were looked at. One challenge is that although we can, for many possibilities in terms of increasing revenue, speculate about how much revenue that might raise, most of them are fairly indeterminate. So although they included a list, they weren't able to estimate too precisely how much revenue might be raised by most of them. But there are some revenue increases, some that are relatively straightforward, is to push harder for a more market-based approach to increasing tuition, because our tuition lags, at least for baccalaureate programs, lags well behind most of our peers. So that's just an example of a revenue item that was certainly brought forward.
Okay, any other questions for Cecile, myself, or the Provost?
I have a comment for you. You brought up this Faculty Senate positions that are vacant. Apparently, some of the alternates want to run for the new positions, but they are being told that they cannot. And so you need to clarify that, whether the alternates can run for the positions or not.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that. Thank you, Debo. I'll look into that. Okay, let's move on to governance reports. Brad, do you have anything for us?
Yeah, I'll return it. Yes. So last month I mentioned, and I'll mention again, staff council is, of course, paying attention to the budget process. We weren't part of budget options group, but we did get an opportunity to submit some ideas through the Office of Management and Budget, and then working forward to be working on Planning and Budget Committee to help evaluate some of those options, and then we'll also, of course, be paying attention to the legislature as it goes forward and the news for good or for ill, or what comes out of that process. I also wanted to give the Faculty Senate a quick update on some comments I made in December about the Staff Council's push to have staff show up at the December Board of Regents meeting to speak to the value of the tuition waiver. And we had 125 people, it's not an official headcount, but roughly, show up for public, well, at least show up during public comment, took up the entire time commenting. And I wanted to thank all of you for your encouragement in December, and if you had encouraged staff or encouraged some of your faculty colleagues to go, that was, it's really appreciated. And thank Dave and Cecile, because Faculty Alliance passed a resolution supporting the waiver in December that also went to the Board of Regents. And in the February Board of Regents report, in case anyone's interested, there is a tuition waiver follow-up. It included some interesting numbers, including the waiver brings in $1 million of fees to UAF, or to, sorry, to UA, and that in a survey, a 2012 survey of higher education institutions, 96% of institutions have a waiver program for employees, and 84 to 88% of them cover spouses and dependents. And so I wanted to bring that to this group in case there's any interest there and you ever want to refer back to it.
Sorry, can you say again how many include the dependents?
84 to 88%. Apparently there's some variation depending on how you look at it.
Okay, thank you, Brad. Any questions for Brad? Okay, thank you. Is Brix on here for ASUAF or someone else? Okay, oh, actually, the Chancellor's just joined us. Chancellor Rogers, would you, are you prepared for?
Sure. Good afternoon, everyone. I wanted to discuss briefly budget, and then I can handle any questions. I've spent time in Juneau each of the last 2 weeks. It's not a pretty process this year given the state's revenue picture. I reported to you earlier the governor had approved half of our pay raise money, a little bit of fixed cost, and then took away $14.9 million, leaving us with that as a net budget reduction. The House Finance Subcommittee took the governor's and reduced by another $1 million, so we're $1 million below governor's at the House level. That's certainly disappointing, but there were efforts on the committee to go much lower than that, so I was pleased that the supporters in Juneau were able to hold to only another million. And the Senate, I think, is not quite as bent on reductions. We actually might see a couple of increments added back in the Senate, setting the stage for a conference committee somewhere in between the two. As always, the best predictor of how we end up in our operating budget is what the governor comes in with. That's the best indicator. So that's where I would expect to be on the operating budget side. On the capital side, there is, I think the legislature as a whole has moved from, on the issue of the combined heat and power plant, from do we need it to yes, we need it, and from do we have to do something this year to a yes, we have to do something this year. They haven't figured out what yet, how much to fund and what the mechanism may be. I think the funding for the engineering building is still in play, and funding for several research initiatives in the capital budget still potential for funding. Things will move fairly rapidly. There is a hearing coming up at the end of this week from the House side on the operating budget. People who wish to testify can do so. You get 2 minutes, which isn't much time to cover all the testimony that may come from a community at one time. They've got specific time blocks. So as we plan for the upcoming budget year, I know Susan gave you a brief report before I came. The first stage that I created the budget options group to create essentially take from the university community what ideas there were and try to cost out what the impact of those in dollar terms would be. The Budget Options Group has completed its work and passed it on to the Planning and Budget Committee. Just a couple of caveats, though. These are not priorities. These are not recommendations, but rather a costing out of what the fiscal impact is of options that came forward either through the website or from the committee. It's clear we have a very different fiscal picture than we've had in recent years. I would characterize what my reaction is one of concern rather than panic. I think the state appears to not to really be on a glide path down on the budget rather than going over a cliff on the budget, which creates which makes the reductions a little bit easier to take, I think, in smaller pieces. I fully expect the Planning and Budget Committee will hear from university constituencies, will develop some new options that weren't there coming out of the Budget Options Group, and that that the state will continue to look to not do the kind of cliff reduction we've seen in other states. Now, when a state's sitting on $50 billion in the savings account and $16 billion in the checking account, it's hard to think about the kind of reductions that we're facing, and in a state with no personal taxes on income or other. We're actually in pretty good fiscal shape, notwithstanding the high level of concern coming out of Juneau. But it is true that absent additional oil production, that money, the operating money, will run out in the next couple of years. So I think we need to be prepared for some challenging decisions that the state needs to make over the next couple of years. And with that, Mr. President, I'll take any questions that there may be.
Thank you, Chancellor Rogers. Any questions for the Chancellor? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. Okay, Danny, are you here, Danny Shepherd? Ah, okay, and we move on to United Academics. Falk, do you have anything for us? Okay, and Jane, anything from UFT?
Yeah, I have a report from the Joint Healthcare Committee. The Joint Healthcare Committee met on last Friday, and Healthy Rose, the new wellness vendor, is going to start within a week, and information will be coming out to everybody this week. And then there's some some changes in our healthcare plan for FY15, which will start July 1st. And I'll just summarize real quick. The family, for the 750 and the HDHP plan, the family out-of-pocket maximum on the prescription benefit goes to $1,700. For the HDHP and the CDHP, the dental preventive benefit will increase to 100%, and everything else will stay the same. And for beginning with the plan year in July 1st, there will no longer be any pre-existing condition exclusion for any individual. So it goes for everybody now. It was for everyone under 19 before, but now it'll be for everybody. And there will be a reduced health rate for 2014-15 if you and your spouse, either one or both, fill out a personal health assessment and complete your biometric screenings by June 30th. And since it's so late, they're going to be offering various things, and we'll hear about those within the week as well. That's all I have.
Thank you, Jane. Just out of curiosity, you say they'll offer a discount. How much of a discount is it? Do you have that?
I think it'll be $50 per month, so $600 a year for the person.
And do you know how the data on that are collected and where they're stored?
I don't know who's collecting it or where it will be stored, but it won't be shared with anyone at the university, we're told. it won't be shared with anyone, health plan or university. I mean, by, you know, personal data, just the aggregate numbers.
We find that out.
Find out who's...
Yeah, kind of like, just sure. Since we're all we're academics or whatever.
Sure.
I mean, I know, are they going to make money off of it? Or it'd be nice to know.
Any other questions for Jane? Okay, thanks, Jane. It's time now for public comment. Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak at this time?
I will.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a statement I'd like to read. I'd like to let you all know that I am very disappointed to inform you all that a non-academic program in this university has been given preference over an academic program in the last 3 weeks. This has been done with the administration's full knowledge and condoned by the administration. I believe this is a sad day for our academics at the university. Unfortunately, this situation is about our students that are losing out of being able to perform at their highest quality because of this choice. I am, however, very happy to report that if something is done about this situation within the next day, that it can be changed and that this will greatly affect our students in their performance.
Okay. Do you have a specific recommendation for us?
I specifically recommend that the administration review the choice in this matter and make a different decision than they've already made.
Yeah, I don't have any.
Some more context would be helpful.
The context is that there is a musical performance, which is an academic class of an ensemble that I direct at the university, and a choice has been made to pull a teaching assistant from the concert in order to provide this teaching assistant to a non-academic program. This performance has been rehearsed for the last 1.5 months with this student involved. At the last minute, this student is being pulled to be doing something that is non-academic against my recommendation and with full knowledge of the administration, including our department chair.
Do we know what the student is going to go do?
Debu, would you like to help me with that? Well, I mean, I would, let's just say it's a non-academic program outside of classes. Although it is a UAF sponsored event, it is a non-academic program.
She's asking, what is the student's job?
I just can't, since I don't know what's happening, I can't make any kind of decision or effort on anyone's behalf. Because, so I don't know, I mean, it's all got to be public, right? I mean, it can't be some secret mission the student sends on.
The student is assigned to both an academic class, which is the UAF Wind Symphony,
okay,
as well as the athletic pep band, equally,
okay,
and is being pulled from the academic concert in favor of the pep band.
So
the student has no agency in choosing.
The student, I have not talked to, as I don't want to put the student in the middle, but another faculty member has informed me that the student will be doing this, and it's been supported.
So just in the name of getting information out, Provost Henricks has offered to talk briefly on this.
Well, the main thing that I was able to say at this point was to clarify what Dr. Gustafson did already, which is that this is a TA that is split between the pet band and the Wind Symphony. It turns out that two important events were scheduled on the same day, one the Wind Symphony performance, the other Governor's Cup hockey game, which is where the pet band was scheduled to perform. And so there's a very difficult to resolve time conflict for the students. This is a music department and an inter-faculty conflict. I did, so I have not intervened for that reason. I don't feel that I have all of the facts or information that I need to intervene, and that this is something that the department should settle for itself. And so that's the situation.
Okay, thank you, Provost Hendricks. Any other questions for Dr. Gustafson? And Karen, if there's something that you would like the Faculty Senate to do, I'd entertain. But
I just wanted to make people aware of the situation that there are two events that have been scheduled. The Wind Symphony, of which I'm the director, schedules our concerts 1 to 2 years out, and I had no idea of this conflict until 3 weeks ago. And the Music Department's policy has always been that an academic class takes priority of over outside events. This is not being upheld.
Okay, thank you. All right. I mentioned in my remarks that Outstanding Faculty Senator of the Year awards, the nominations are open, and here they are under old business. I should have looked first. But there is an additional piece of information, which is the closing date is March 24th. That ensures that we have sufficient time to conclude our deliberations on whom to select. Similarly, the nominations are now open for president-elect for the next year's Faculty Senate. I can assure you that it is a great, I really enjoy doing this, as crazy as that may sound, but it's been a wonderful year, a couple of years for me. And I think Cecile might even confess to enjoying it somewhat herself. If you are interested in this, we would ask that you please submit your nomination to Jane in sufficient time that you have time to complete a personal statement that can be available by March 23rd. There's a mistake in the agenda, so it should be available by March 23rd, not April 23rd. The election for next year's president-elect will take place at the next Faculty Senate meeting, which is April 7th. Okay. And at this point, we're going to move on to, are there any questions about that? Yes, Jane.
Can I make a nomination now?
If you'd like.
I'd like to nominate Debu. Okay.
Thank you.
Debu, you've been nominated. If you choose to be a candidate for president-elect, Debu, you'll need to make sure that you get a personal statement into Jane by March 23rd. That's the only deadline I'm aware of for this. Okay. I'm not asking you to speak or anything. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Jane. Let's see. Yes.
Can you clarify that... You've got a date for nominations in here of April 7th. That's going to be March 7th then also? Or
no, the election is April 7th, and the personal statement must be in by March 23rd. That's a typo.
Nominations are due April 7th.
March 23rd.
It says statements due April 23rd. I think that's
what you're talking about. Oh, yes. And so you can get in, you can be nominated at the next meeting. That's correct. You may. In which case, you'd have to bring in a personal statement.
And a note from your mom.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that, Ken. Yeah. Okay, I noticed that Franz Meyer is not here to talk about the electronic course evaluation work group, but I do see Eric. Did you intend to speak to this, Eric? Is that correct?
Thank you. I hope that most of you have seen the report that's posted with the agenda. Franz and I have been co-chairing a group that is comprised essentially of FDAI and then a group of faculty, staff, and administrators actually from across the campus that over the past 2 years have looked at a number of systems. 2 years ago, we looked at 12 systems initially for electronic course evaluation, and then this year winnowed that down to four. And you have that report in front of you. I should say at the outset that there's one typo in here. The hyphen in student free responses is supposed to be between free and responses. We are not looking for responses that are free of students, so I apologize for that mistake. The recommendation that's contained in this report was actually fairly easy. Of the four systems that the committee looked at, one clearly stood out head and shoulders above the others. One of the particular reasons, not the only one, but one of the reasons was that the committee felt it was pretty important to maintain a paper and electronic hybrid system, simply because there are students who may not yet have access to electronic means to complete it. There are field-based courses where that might be difficult. So for a variety of reasons, the committee thought that was important. Two of the systems would not accommodate a hybrid system at all. It would be entirely up to UAF to maintain it, although one did say that if we wanted to collect the data and ship it to them, then they would, for a custom programming fee, would then integrate it and send it back to us. The third system was essentially still talking about shipping paper back and forth. They would print the forms, ship them to us, we would deploy them, collect them, ship them back to the company, and then the company would integrate it and send us an electronic report. So that really didn't sound very much like a hybrid system. One of the suggestions that's come up in conversations over the past few months is that the committee do a side-by-side comparison. We really would prefer not to do that, simply because when you post something, I mean, we can do it in a face-to-face meeting, but when you post something on the website, then one of the companies comes back and says, well, you didn't present our system in the best light, or this piece of information we see differently. And it's essentially begging for a kind of a fight that we really don't need. So what we tried to do was to highlight the strengths of the system that the committee is recommending without getting into anything that might be construed as denigrating any of the other systems. The company, one of the requests was to see if there was a video that we could show today. The only thing that they really have is a 47-minute video, which obviously wouldn't work today. But I've talked to Jane, and we can post that on the website and make that link available so that you can actually see how the system works, and it's the company that will do a demonstration of it. So I think that's the short version. A couple of things that we can anticipate. One is people are concerned about response rates. Obviously, that's important. The comment that seemed to the committee to be most helpful was that response rates, obviously, the quality of the system is relevant. Nobody likes to use a clunky system of any kind, and a system that works very well is going to be attractive. But by and large, response rates are less a function of the system themselves than they are of the institutions where they're deployed. What are our attitudes toward response rates? How do we present that information to students? Do instructors tell students that it's something that's important to them personally, and these are the ways I use it, and those kinds of things? So that's something that we need to think about. And then the other thing, obviously, is cost. The information that I have says that it will be about the same or perhaps even a little less than our current system, but I don't know if Provost Henricks wants to add some information to that.
I can just briefly add to that. Dr. Madsen got information from the vendor about the cost of the proposed system. It has a little bit of initial cost that is a little higher than the annual cost, but even if you average all that together over 5 years, it would be about 20% cheaper, at least in one of the options that was presented to me, than our current system. So there's that potential savings, which is fairly small on an annual basis. But there is also a more substantial savings, which has to do with the time that people are spending to process the paper forms. In my office, that amounts to probably 2 weeks of someone's time over the course of the year dealing with various aspects of the paper forms, sending them out, sorting them, and so on. There's also a time spent for the individual units. That's probably in most units about 30 to 40 hours worth of time for our larger units anyway. For smaller ones, of course, it would be less. And then finally, there is a time commitment of the faculty and students to filling out the paper forms during class time. So that's an additional time commitment. So that's an additional savings by instituting the electronic course evaluations, although it's not as tangible as dollars.
I'd like to add one more thing to this that was part of the discussion. It had to do with the flexibility of the system to add questions either at the university or the department or the instructor level. And the system that we're recommending is really quite flexible about being able to add questions. One of the, to me anyway, great benefits of that is that programs can do program assessment, outcomes evaluation, partly by using, partly by querying students at the end of their courses. So that can, in some ways, make outcomes assessment a lot more efficient as well.
I think also related to the question of cost is what you're getting, what we are getting for any system that we use. As Cecile pointed out, there's some advantages in electronic systems that simply aren't available in paper systems. For example, if a student gives an extreme response, either extremely strong or extremely negative, then in this particular system, there's a text box that opens up and says, "Would you like to explain why you feel that way?" Student doesn't have to. It doesn't, you know, doesn't invalidate the survey if the student doesn't, but it is an option. And the company last week released as a part, this is not an additional cost item, but as a part of the system, essentially what's an ongoing polling feature that any individual faculty member can use at his or her discretion, which essentially negates the need for in a midterm evaluation, which is one of the things that the committee was particularly interested in. So that, say, for example, one day you find yourself spending a little more time on one concept than you thought you were going to, you could very quickly poll students and say, "I made this decision on the spur of the moment. Was that a good one? Was that something that I should continue doing?" Or those kinds of things that can feed back immediately into our instruction.
Now, you may, let me just make a quick comment. You may all be wondering why we're talking about this. It just sort of occurred to me that, you know, I should probably explain. This is available for us, the committee's recommendation, and it is available on the faculty website. There is also going to be a discussion forum there, all of which is preparatory to development of a motion at hopefully April's meeting concerning adoption of the committee's recommendation. So this is something that the Senate will act on. So this is the opening, as I understand it. Is that correct, Eric?
Yes.
And so this is the opening of essentially our opportunity to discuss this, and but it's not the close of it. So go ahead.
So I just had a question. With the current paper system, the students' responses are anonymous, whereas with an electronic system, you could track the comments of individual students. Is there any tracking by student in the system or not?
No. All of the systems that we looked at seriously, this was a big item for them, obviously, because it's important to us, and they're aware of that. This, what they were calling their forum, for example, all of the student, that constant polling option is conducted as a class forum so that the students can see each other's responses. They can see a vote, much like you do with use with clickers or something like that, but the responses themselves are anonymous. And the reports that Cecile mentioned, for example, if one of the sections the faculty at Fairbanks often say they find most valuable are the students' comments that come directly to us and to us only, as opposed to the numerical concepts, those are still available to us as individual faculty members. And on things like co-taught courses, you can separate out the comments so that the comments go to the particular instructor who's involved.
Susan, you said that one variety of the program would cost a little bit less than currently. Is this a hybrid or is this the electronic only?
Eric may have better recall of the estimates that he obtained, but it really is the way we choose to purchase this. If we choose to purchase it, there's a lease option, which is kind of renting it, and then there's an option to buy the software, which then has a lower out-year cost. And so actually the average prices of the two averaged over about a five-year period are fairly similar, but in the purchase option you pay more to start with and much less going out, and it, with the lease option it's more even.
And yes, by the way, the both quotes that the company provided did include the paper option, and they all also included hosting by the company. Now, we don't have to take advantage of that. We could host it here if we chose. But they essentially put in the full service option if you want, so we could reduce that further.
Okay, anyone else? Debu.
Yes, I know this has been brought up before in the Faculty Senate, but I would like to bring it up again. Recently, we had a discussion university-wide faculty, you know, and UAA has an electronic feedback or course evaluation system. I don't like the course evaluation because students are not evaluating courses. They are giving their opinion of instruction. So that part is something that bothers me, that it's not a course evaluation. But anyway, even if we called it a course evaluation, there has been really, really very small response in UAA. Like out of a class of 50, only two students or three students have responded. Are we planning not to include this in the faculty evaluations for promotion tenure evaluation, or are we still going to do that? I mean, this, yeah, please.
Eric, do you want to address that?
Let me respond to part of it.
Okay.
And then I'll leave it to the provost to respond to the second part. The first part is we had a very, very helpful conversation with Mark Fitch, who I understand is he now?
Yes, he's the president of him.
And he's been president-elect. I think he actually did a previous term. And it was extremely helpful, and he was very candid. Part of their problems are the system that they chose. And just to give you one example, if a student doesn't complete all of the responses, then the survey is considered incomplete and doesn't count. And it goes on from there. Anytime they want to change it in any way, they have to accept the base set of questions, because this company is highly oriented toward a norm statistical model. So if the university wants to add questions, those have to be on top of the base set, which makes the survey even longer. So it was very, very interesting and helpful to talk to Mark. So.
Okay. What was the next?
A couple of points. One is that offering the opportunity for students to provide feedback on instruction and on the courses that on their overall experience in a course, and there are questions in our current IAS system, and there will be questions, I think, in the new system that relate both to the instruction and to the course. That's something that our accrediting organization expects us to do. And I think also that many faculty benefit from the feedback of their students in this assessment. I do agree, though, that it's important to have a representative sample of students responding, that when you have very low response rates, there's some risk that only the most disgruntled students will respond because they're the most strongly motivated to do so. The use of student evaluations in the promotion and tenure process is subject to our academic judgment. It's subject to my academic judgment, that of deans. It's subject to the judgment of your unit peer members. I think all of those individuals, and certainly me, when I look at IAS scores, if the response rates are extremely low, I don't give them as much credence as I would if there were a reasonable response rate. That's just sensible. With a new electronic system, we should do everything that we can to make response rates appropriate and get good widespread feedback from our students. But if it should turn out that initially, for example, during the transition, the response rates are relatively low, I think that all of the committees and individuals that are responsible for faculty evaluation can and will take into account that you can't give as much credence to information if it's only being provided by a very small number of students.
Okay. Let's have maybe, all right, last two comments, Chris and then Ken.
Okay, I just have one question that I'm going to put forth about this as something for reflection. I'm not sure what I think about it at this point. I'm interested to feel in what you said about the way in which the system could be also used to streamline outcomes assessment. However, I think that if we do that, we need to reflect carefully on how and leave it up to departments. If the data can't be disaggregated from individual instruction and individual instructors, that would be a problem. If it could be put in a general pool of everyone teaching the same course, then that could be a very helpful mechanism. But I think it's worth reflecting on the extent we want to have the generalized collection of assessment data conflated with the process of student opinion of instruction in individual courses, given all of the different variables that are involved. Again, I'm not saying I'm not in favor of it. I'm just saying that this is something we need to reflect on carefully as we go forward.
I agree, absolutely.
All right, thank you. And Ken?
Do you have a list of schools currently using this system, or could you get us a list of schools made available so that faculty could call up colleagues at other schools and understand a little bit more about the strengths and weaknesses before we get an opportunity to discuss this in open forums?
Yes, absolutely. That would be a good thing to do. I mean, that's based on our conversation with the UAA and what we learned from them, I think that's a very good idea. So, if I could just add, I would really encourage you to look at the specifics in this report. I know everybody's busy, but this has been a very thoughtful and a very constructive conversation, I think. And obviously what we want to do is arrive at a good decision for UAF, whatever that may be. So I hope that you'll take the time to look at it and participate in the discussion. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Eric. Appreciate you coming by for this. Okay, let's move on to new business. We have three motions from unit criteria meeting, all concerning reaffirming unit criteria. And Chris, I'm wondering if it would be appropriate for me in your eyes to suggest that all three be voted on at the same time.
I think that would be appropriate.
Okay. So, Chris, do you want to introduce the which units are have submitted?
This is attachment 197.8, and let me see, I'm paging through to it. Oh, okay. Well, the first one appears in our packet as 197/1, and it has to do with the School of Management, and the School of Management is asking us to readopt their existing unit criteria that were approved in previous rounds of review. The committee is in agreement. The criteria has been working for the Department of U.S. The next one is for the Department of Music, which has submitted new unit criteria to us, and they've done so in order to further clarify and specify the criteria that are appropriate for their discipline that should be used to evaluate their faculty. This one is different than their previous document, but it's the view of the committee that the proposed changes would enhance the fairness of the evaluation process, and so we recommend the approval of these as well. And the third one is the criteria for the graduate program in marine science and limnology, and this one had some very minor edits to the existing document that had been approved in previous rounds. The changes had to do with changes in the name of the program, and they weren't substantive. We also recommend approving these readopted criteria with the minor changes to the name of the program.
So I'd make a comment at this point that setting unit criteria is one of the more important things that the Faculty Senate does as part of its role in academics. To a great extent, however, we trust that the unit criteria, which has been ably led by Dr. Kaufman, has carefully reviewed these, because these are fairly long documents for everybody to look through. So unless someone has an objection for this, I would essentially ask, well, let me ask, does anyone have a concern or wish to speak against passing all three motions?
How about a quick comment?
Go right ahead, Debu.
Yeah. Being in the unit criteria committee, there has been several times that the members have brought up that there are some language issues in the existing criteria, university criteria, that needs to be cleaned up at some point of time. The grammatical and other stuff. Chris, you can remember a couple of comments.
Are you talking about the
the existing ones? Yeah.
You mean the existing ones for
the blue book.
Or the template?
Yeah. Yeah, the Blue Book template.
The Blue Book template, I saw some minor grammatical issues, nothing that was substantive.
Right. I'm just bringing that up so that...
No, but I have a comment.
Javier, go ahead.
There were some elements in the last one that we reviewed that were
not applicable for that specific school. And then when we came to the discussion, it was said that because this was a document that were before already sent, so we were to discuss the new relevant. I think that that was the comment that...
You actually brought up, I think, you were confused about some language.
Yeah, because
So I'm going to jump in here. I think what I'm hearing is that there's some concern that the existing template, university-wide template...
has nothing to do with this. Yeah.
Okay. I would like to... this particular set of... three sets of unit criteria. And if there is... let's see.
I move we accept all three.
Thank you. All right, do I have a second?
And if there,
I'll second it.
Thank you.
If there are specific concerns about the current Blue Book template, please send them to me.
Okay.
So we can put that in the revision.
That's right. Cecile is working on that, trying to finish up the revisions to that, so that would be helpful. Okay. Anyone object to adoption of these three motions?
Question.
Yes, go ahead.
No, I'm calling the question, please.
Oh. Thank you. I was sort of assuming. All right. Without objection, I don't see any objections, so the three motions carry unanimously. And we move on to motion D, which is recommending amending the UAF regulation for emeritus status, submitted by the Administrative Committee, which is attachment 197/4. Essentially, all that motion does is it clarifies some language with respect to where documents should go, who hands off the documents to whom, so that it's clear from the policy how the committee should handle this. So okay, and is there any discussion on that? Okay.
Move to approve.
Thank you. And second? Who seconded? A bunch of people. Donnie did. Okay. And are there any objections to this motion? Seeing none, the motion carries unanimously. And we are 5 minutes late for a break, so let's make it as brief a break as possible and reconvene at, let's say, 2:12.
Dave, could I jump in, please?
Oh, yes, please, Reiner. Yes.
Could I get you to take a look at the rationale for the motion on page 31 during the next few minutes, please? I mean, while you're breaking.
That's a motion, that's attachment 197/6. Just, and everyone should have a look at that. Yes. Thank you, Reiner.
Thank you.
Okay, please grab a seat.
Somebody change the page.
Okay. Okay. Welcome back. Thanks for being prompt. I appreciate it. We move next to motion E to amend academic probation policy, which is submitted by the Curricular Affairs Committee. Reiner Newberry, can you speak to that, please?
Excuse me, David. This is Tori Baker. I'm just checking in. A couple of us have joined.
I'm sorry. Could you say that again? I couldn't hear you.
Sure. This is Tori Baker, and I'm just checking in. A couple of us have just joined on the line.
Okay. Thank you, Tori. Jane's noting it.
Thanks.
Yeah, who's the other person who's just joined?
Did anyone besides Tori just join? Okay, go ahead, Reiner.
Hi. As you know, student academic success is a major concern, and one aspect of that is how we can use our probation policies to help students as opposed to merely punish them. So every few years, we try something a little bit different. And several years ago, we came up with what we thought was a brilliant idea, namely having students do a plan, get it approved, send it to their dean, and hold the students to such a plan before they can register if they are on probation. As part of a longer-term sort of rethinking of how to do probation, and in particular to try to establish a three-tier policy, it was recognized that the policy that we created several years ago just isn't being used. And the motion in front of you is basically to take out the part which is simply not happening, so that, in fact, anybody who reads it understands what really does happen. Now, our objective is to replace the what's not going on with something new and better next year, but in order to get in the catalog, we need to make the change now so that the catalog will be different for next year. And then next year we plan to present to the Faculty Senate a new and improved probation. So the purpose of this motion is to basically to clean up the language in the catalog so it actually reflects what we do. It's a pity that what we proposed didn't work, but it doesn't work, and it's not being used.
Okay. Discussion. Amy?
Yeah, I'm strongly, or I feel strongly about this, and I think it is being used in the sense that I had a student who went through this process with me, and I genuinely feel that by going through the process with me, this student turned his academic career around because he was forced to have a stronger relationship with me as his advisor than he initially had, and I don't. So I have personal experience with this, and I feel that it works. So if it's not being used ever at all, I don't know if that's the problem of the language in the catalog that requires the student to do something extra because he or she's on probation, or if something's happening within the administration or the registrar's office or whatever unit of the bureaucracy that's allowing students to register without having an academic plan on file. But I strongly feel that it's healthy and important for these students to have to acquire an academic advisor and draw out a plan, because so many of the students get frustrated and end up on probation because they've never had one-on-one contact with anybody to help them create a plan that will work for them. So I could see maybe making some changes. Maybe they don't. The student isn't responsible for taking it to the dean. Maybe the advisor is, or just to a department chair or something. But I don't like the idea that we would remove this. And if we are really going to, then I'd like to know why actually it's not working.
Faculty are not forwarding the plans to the appropriate academic dean, and we have no mechanism in place to prevent a student from registering without having such a plan forwarded. There's nothing in the revised language that would say a student doesn't have to make a plan. All it says is that, in fact, what this whole business with the dean is going to be eliminated because it's not happening.
Right, but the student, it doesn't in any way, in the revised version, require the student to seek advice from anybody. It just still leaves the student alone to fix his or her GPA problem.
So are you proposing that instead of the word should, which is bolded, we replace that with will?
Well, that's what is currently in existence.
That's right. And so are you suggesting that we leave that wording alone?
I don't know. This is I'm not on your committee. I haven't thought this through. I just think that we need the student, to me, the student should work with an academic advisor to prepare an academic plan for achieving a higher GPA, and the student shouldn't be able to register unless the plan's on file.
And we have no way to enforce that.
Well, why can't we fix that instead of removing this?
That's something that we're going to be working on as part of a larger scale revision of the probation policy for next year. In the short term, we want to take out from the catalog what we're not doing.
So just to jump in, one way that we could handle this is that there's language, there's two basic changes that this is making. One is replacing will with should, and the other is removing the mechanism of how that plan is transmitted. And that second part is what's not working. Would unamending this, the will to should, so it reverts to will, so I'm asking you, Amy, would that largely take care of the concern that you have? In other words, let's suppose that this remained as will, but that other language that just simply isn't happening is taken out. That really doesn't change the sense that the student really must do that, although
we have no enforcement mechanism.
Which we don't anyway.
Agreed.
Is that so?
Are you asking if that satisfies me?
Yes.
No.
Okay. Chris?
So I have a question. Is it your sense, Reiner, that students are in fact not coming up with a plan with the advisor, or alternatively that students are coming up with a plan with an advisor, but it somehow is not making
its way up to the dean's office.
My sense is it's not making its way to the dean's office, and that there isn't any clever way to get from the dean's office to the registrars. It just isn't. It's just not working.
I want to acknowledge that Provost Hendricks would like to make a comment.
Just a quick comment in that any enforcement of the will or not is in the hands of the academic advisor because we have mandatory advising. The advisor is supposed to approve the student to register. Individual advisors need to work with the student to come up with a plan that satisfies the advisor before making that determination. Right now, there isn't a mechanism to do that centrally, to do the checking of it centrally, but I hope we can trust in advisors to be responsible in their advising of students.
Okay.
The reason for bringing this up now is essentially we're at the catalog deadline for next year. Either we make the change now as essentially a Band-Aid to our probation policy in preparation for some significant changes next year, in which case the catalog next year reflects the reality, or we don't make the change now, in which case the catalog lies.
I think the catalog does no harm if we leave it the way it is now. But in my mind, you're asking us to trust that this gets changed and then an ongoing suite of other changes comes in after it. And I personally would rather vote on a package than an isolated thing that, to me, if it's not being enforced, then I don't see why there's any vested interest in changing this. And it doesn't lie because I went through this process with at least one student. So in my instance, I didn't lie, or the catalog didn't lie.
Okay. I saw your hand first.
So I just have a question. This academic plan is relatively recent. So do we have any data that it's had any effect on the ability of students to recover from being on probation, or do we know whether to the extent it has been followed, whether it's done anything, achieved anything?
We haven't done that specific study. Our retention and graduation rates are going up gradually through a number of different changes that we've made in advising and placement and so forth. It's a little hard to isolate any one particular change. We are getting better success for students. It's hard to tell whether this particular thing is helping.
Debu? Oh, I'm sorry. Falk had his hand.
When I have these problems, I usually go to the assigned departmental student advisors. What do they recommend? Are they happy with what you suggest? Is it coming from them? Or, you know, we have people that are assigned as to help with student advising, and they usually know the insides out. Are they completely recommending what you're saying? Is that completely in line? I missed that, perhaps.
I don't understand your question. Could you repeat it, please?
Is that what you're recommending there? Is that coming from your own working group, or is it part of the student advice, the people in the department that are assigned to advise students, student advisors? Is that coming from them, or are they part of this decision, of this wording?
It's coming from the working group that's putting together a revised policy on probation.
Right. So my question is, what would the people from the department say that are actually doing the advising on the ground every day? Are they happy with that change?
If it's not being enforced, I mean, we might as well say students on probation must stand on their head and spit BBs for 5 minutes.
No, that's not what I asked. My question is, what do the student advisors really say? Are they happy with that change?
I have no idea, but I would think that no one would be pleased about a statement that's supposed to be essentially a legal contract that's not being enforced.
I think Vice Provost Fitz may have some input on that question.
I don't actually have input
on that
question, but I just want to say this originated from a conversation with the registrar's office looking at the probation policies overall and the difficulty or impossibility from their point of view of enforcing this, and the registrar can certainly weigh in on that. We certainly encourage and want students to develop an academic plan, and hopefully they're doing that before they're on probation. but there's nothing in this change that should change the relationship between an advisor and a student who's in academic difficulty. They should still be meeting with their advisor, as it says here, and developing an academic plan. It's the what happens to it after that that we're acknowledging is a problem right now.
Agreed.
Okay. Okay. Any other comments about this? Karen? Yeah.
I was just going to support what Alex said in that, you know, we looked at this as a committee and the word will as opposed to should. I mean, the fact of the matter is that advice from an advisor is simply just that, and that, you know, enforcing that the student will work from the advisor and therefore take the advice is something that you just simply can't enforce. And so should work with an advisor is an advice to the student. You should work with an advisor and you should develop an academic plan. And I think we heard, correct me if I'm wrong, from a dean, at least one dean, that making sure that this happens and goes through the dean's office and is approved by the dean is an overwhelming task for them, and it's very difficult to uphold that part of it.
Okay. Maybe one more comment.
So just a comment. It seems to me that if you stick with the word will, you're imposing an additional requirement on the student and therefore providing another opportunity for them to not recover from their problems. If you make it should, then they can recover without having to jump that hurdle, and so presumably it makes it easier for them to achieve success rather than placing another constraint on them.
No, it's making it easier to register.
Okay. Has everybody made up their minds how they want to vote on this? All right. Let's see. I'm going to assume that the Curricular Affairs Committee has essentially made this motion. Can I have a second on this?
Second.
And let's go ahead and vote. It seems to me that this is one of those things we'll have to actually do a quick vote with ayes and nays. So all in favor of this motion, please say so. Signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, aye. All those opposed, please say nay.
Nay.
Head count.
I think we have to do a head count.
Yes.
Jane, are you ready to do that? Should we just do a show of hands? Let's try a show of hands. That's a little bit quicker than doing a full roll call. Those in favor, please raise your hands and keep them up until Jane has counted you. Okay, and online, can I get just one at a time? Say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
I heard three. Okay, and nays, please raise your hand. And online nays, please, one at a time now.
Nay.
Okay, I heard one. Okay, the motion carries 18 to 13. Thanks very much. We move now to motion F, which is on attachment 197/6. It is a motion to revise non-UA transfer courses for perspectives on the human condition, and it's submitted by the Curricular Affairs Committee. Again, Dr. Reiner Newberry will initiate this discussion.
We brought this to your attention in December to test the waters, find out what kind of objections there were. We received several comments at that meeting, mostly requests for additional information, as well as people who were simply opposed. I'd like to ask your indulgence to spend a couple of minutes addressing those points that were raised, and which is what we've been doing for the last couple of meetings. The version that's before you now has been unanimously approved by Curricular Affairs Committee. Point number one was that people made earlier was that this will only affect a small number of students. In fact, Registrar's office has shown this data that approximately 1,300 students transfer in per year. Roughly half of these have problems transferring perspectives on human resource, human conditions courses, which is what this motion covers, so that roughly 500 students per year are affected by the potential change in policy. The second point that was raised was, well, we're changing our core requirements anyway, imminently, there's really no need to do this. In fact, we're at least a year away from having a change in our undergraduate requirements. And frankly, what's proposed here is in the spirit of what's being suggested. So we don't envision any revision in this policy necessary when we change our undergraduate requirements, if in fact the current notions of how we do that would work. In the meantime, just by having this in place for 1 year, roughly 500 students would get a smiley face from UAF instead of a frowny face. We would allow students, another objection was we would allow students to graduate from UAF without having taken our complete core requirements. This is true, but we already do that. We issue core waivers for students who have either have an AA or AS degree or students who have completed their core at the school they're transferring from. In addition, there's a backdoor policy that some faculty and some schools encourage their students to adopt. Namely, if you transfer to UAA, which has a more liberal policy concerning required social science, humanities, and arts classes, and then transfer from UAA to UAF, then because they've been accepted at UAA, they must be accepted at UAF. Effectively, this backdoor policy means that students in the know can take advantage of our policies, and students not in the know don't. They wind up having to retake essentially a core class that they took in good faith at a different institution, but it wasn't the right one here. So that making this change would basically make it fair for everybody to have that situation. A fourth objection was that this would decrease our credit hour production, and I would argue that it'll simply mean that a student, instead of having to retake a class that's a different version of one they already took elsewhere, they'd be spending their tuition dollars taking classes in their major or courses they want to take, and hence would simply redistribute what those 120 credits for graduation would be, but not decrease the total number of credits they take. Finally, I would like to point out that this motion has been unanimously approved by the Curricular Review Committee. It's been endorsed by the Registrar, by the Provost, by the Dean of General Studies, by the Faculty Senate President, and by the Faculty Senate soon-to-be President. Thank you.
Okay. Discussion. Amy?
We're in the research to make this motion, were the chairs of any of these departments consulted? Are they behind this? Did they think it was a good idea? So like, was the chair of English or history or political science or anthropology asked about this plan?
No.
And I have an additional question. Do you have any information about the viewpoints of the chairs of either the Core Review Committee or the General Education Revitalization Committee? As we all know, the general education curriculum is currently being revised. What's being proposed is something that's more flexible in the way that this transfer proposal is, but it's not in place yet. And in my view, there are certain parts of the spirit of the core curriculum that will drop out should we allow this transfer policy to come into place prematurely before GIRC actually goes through. So I'd be interested in knowing if you received any information from the Core Review or GIRC chairs about their views.
No.
Chris, I'm wondering if I could get you to elaborate on what will your concern about something dropping out before the new general education requirements come into play.
Right. Well, I think there are various ways in which this changes the spirit of the core, and that's something that would need to be done by the Senate as a whole on the outcome of GIRC.
The specific concern that comes to mind, first and foremost, is that currently History 100X and World Literature, English Foreign Languages 200X, have a diversity component to them, and there's nothing that will assure us that a student transferring in whatever course in the social sciences or whatever course in the humanities has that kind of a component. And here it needs to be noted that this opens up the potential for transfers far more broadly than even history or literature, which increases the possibility that that component of the core will disappear.
So the reason why I asked for an elaboration on that was that it seems to me, and my anticipation is that when GERC's work is done and passes through curricular affairs and comes to the Senate, at that point, any existing infrastructure concerning how we do transfers and so forth will all have to be reconsidered at that point. I don't know that this necessarily sets the policy for after the new general education requirements come into play.
No, my point is that it's simply premature.
All right. Dean Herman?
Yeah, so I think this proposal has strong support from the academic deans. We've talked about it quite a bit at our weekly breakfasts that we have. It's certainly a big deal for the School of Management. I mean, we think about transferring this core, and we're one of the schools that has our students, transfer students go down to UAA. We get them accepted. It costs an extra $50 and a bunch of hassle, then they transfer back to UAF. It's really important here is, you know, do the students have a foundation of courses that will allow them to then succeed in our courses? And this isn't something, when we look at these transfers, we shouldn't be looking course by course. We should just sort of take a holistic view. We have a lot of transfer students, and the area that we're really growing is online transfer students. It is very difficult. We have some programs now, the last 2 years are solely online. For these students who want to go to an online program, they have to pick up these particular courses if they already have a core. It's one of our fastest growing programs, Mercy Management, which we've gone from like 0 to 120 majors in 4 or 5 years, will really benefit from this policy. But so will our other students. And lastly, I should say, you know, we're really in some financial difficulties now. I spent this weekend with my financial officer looking at various scenarios on pullbacks for the next 3 years, and it's pretty bad. We do have to pay attention to finances and trying to get these students in. The marginal cost of these students is very low, but they could bring additional revenues. And it could be substantial, I think. So I think I strongly, and I speak for most of the deans, strongly support this proposal.
Well, other comments? Amy?
Well, I don't know. If we're talking about who all supports this outside of our own perspective and personal views, and we take on faith that these other people support it, then I'll just say that my constituents don't support this. They feel strongly that there's something to be said that we have the core and we still have the core until the core leaves us, and the core is in place because it demands that our students here at UAF, the flagship institute here in the state of Alaska, want to make sure that students have a particular kind of education by the time they finish a degree. And until we make that formal change, they don't view the long, hard work that they take as well, I would add, to create this kind of education and to manage these kinds of courses to be innovative, and they're all integrative as well, that now any other course in the social sciences can count. So that essentially would mean that somebody who takes modern world history would have in another course, I guess, and if somebody just takes world history, if I'm reading this right, will then be able to say that they took political economy or individual society and culture as well, because that course would count. So I guess what I would like to say.
Ultimately, our objective is to produce students who will educate themselves.
Is
and
that
who
your,
who don't need to take a specific class in order to know something about a particular topic. If anything, we want to create students who have intellectual curiosity. When they want to know something about Bosnia, by God, they'll find out something about Bosnia. The purpose, and we can argue endlessly about the fact that some schools in the lower 48 require American history instead of world history. The point is that a student has taken a class in good faith as required by their core, and now they come to UAF, and by God, it's the wrong course. there's merit in saying, tough luck, and there's merit in saying, what the heck, you know something about history, and we're going to help you develop as an intellectual student who will learn what you need to learn as you go along in your life.
So Cecile, then Ken, then Laura. So, go ahead.
I think one thing to keep in mind here, and two people have sort of touched on this now, is to kind of take a more holistic look rather than a course-by-course perspective on this. If we say that the general education requirements are there really to expose students to a variety of topics and a variety of ways of looking and quantifying and analyzing and whatever things, and that includes human diversity in various ways, there are many different ways of getting to that goal. So UAF has its core, and you know, and at some point that was sort of an agreement the faculty came to that this was one good way of doing that. Other universities have done that in a similar way. And I think at some point, and I just kind of put this out for consideration, we might want to say, okay, you know, these other schools may not do it in exactly the same way that we have done it for the last 20 years, but it's okay. It still produces basically the same outcome of students who can think critically and who have some sense of history and have, you know, some knowledge about the political system and who can appreciate human diversity and all those other good things. But they've just gone about it in a different way. They've had different experiences at their institutions where probably there was a lot more human diversity than there is at UAF. And various other factors. So I think what is offered in any one single course is probably not the best indicator of whether a student has really learned what we wanted them to learn.
Ken?
I would think that, in my view, this proposal is in line with both Board of Regents and GERC. Board of Regents advocates free flow of courses across campuses, and if you look at their policies, they're very broad in what they consider to be part of the general education requirements. If you look at GERC, GERC is going towards a very student-oriented, flexible approach to selection of the general education requirements. So if anything, I would see this being in line with what GERC is going to when they do finally process things.
And Laura, and then Doni?
Want to say similar things to what Cecile said, and so essentially what is really the purpose of this core? And the purpose is to provide some general education, so it doesn't really matter what the course name.
Thank you, Laura. And Doni?
I just had a question, which is, would passing this motion make it possible for a UAF student who doesn't want to take one of these courses to take it online at a different institution and then get credit for it in lieu of taking the regular requirements?
It is possible. It will cost the student more.
Right. We tend to be the cost leader with respect to these things. So we asked the same question in the admin committee, I believe, and that was pretty much the answer, was that a rational student probably wouldn't do that. Okay. And maybe two more. Anna?
Okay. I have to say that I feel profoundly uncomfortable with this idea. I'm not very good at expressing myself, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to express everything that's bothering me. It usually takes me 2 days to figure it out. But it seems to me that we have certain expectations of students, and we want to give them the very word core assumes that there's a core knowledge that we want them to have. And I see many students coming in that don't have that knowledge, and it makes it very difficult to teach certain courses when I expect them at a certain level to have information that they don't have. In the past, if students have transferred in, and I've been an advisor, they come to me and I can look at their syllabus and I can negotiate with them, does this meet what we have offered before, does it not meet? If we just sort of give a blanket, you've taken core courses elsewhere, that'll do. Where is our opportunity to, what's the word? Control is the wrong word, but where is our ability to shapes, or I don't know. I'm missing a word here in my head, but know that these students are coming out with what we want them to have. And I can tell you that many of the students I'm seeing coming to some of my classes are not prepared and do not have that core. And I would be very, very loath to say, come in with anything. I'm not quite sure I'm reading this correctly, but substitute a history course for any social science course. No. There's a reason that we want students to know something about history. We want students to think, and we want to encourage them to take what they want to take and to become thinkers. But in each and every course that we teach, we should be encouraging critical thinking. But that doesn't negate the need to have a common cultural background. That's what I have to say.
We already do that. Anybody who comes from UAA can take any social science class, including not a history class, and we give our stamp of approval.
I'm going to, let's see. Laura, you had your...
I'm kind of very disturbed by the notion that we think that UAF is the only university in the United States that can provide, or even worldwide, that can provide this core. That is deeply disturbing. And so other universities may have kind of a different take on it. That doesn't mean those students can't critically think.
All right. This is a this is clearly one that we have a diversity of opinion on. All right. I'll leave the last comment to Registrar Libietti.
Our transfer students, we need to make it easier for our transfer students to come to UAF. And we need to look at the whole, so I agree with those arguments. And there is a trend in accepting, being more liberal in accepting and looking at the whole, so we need to consider that also in light of the GERS and what he said, looking at what the core degrees and intentions are. Many of our students will go look for another course and transfer that in because it's easier. So I want to bring those things up.
Okay.
Should we see the motion has been moved and seconded?
Yes. Can I have a second at least? Okay. Thank you, Laura. And let's. I'm going to go straight to a show of hands. if you favor the motion, if you're in favor of the motion, please raise your hand and keep them up to be counted. Okay. And online.
Aye.
I heard two. Okay, and the nays, please raise your hand and keep them up. I count three here and online. Four here, I'm sorry.
Hey.
Four, I'm sorry. I didn't see you. And online.
One. Nay.
All right, the motion carries. Thank you all for your contributions to this. Right now, we are fairly behind where we want to be in terms of our schedule. I've asked for, we had a couple of guest speakers scheduled. The suggestion has come to me that we seek to postpone one of them. I know that Dr. Gary Kofinas' schedule is really tight with respect to travels and so forth, and so I'm going to ask if Gary, if you're willing to come up and jump ahead at this point. And Francis Isgrig, I'm sorry. While Gary's getting set up, Gary is one of the folks who was on the Interdisciplinary Issues Committee that we put into place last year, and I want to commend Gary for the chair of that committee left the university last summer. There was a good draft of the committee report done, but Dr. Kofinas took that in hand and really hammered it out, and so I give him a lot of credit for this, and he's agreed to come and speak with us today. So thank you, Gary.
Thank you, and tell me if you can hear me, and thank you for inviting me. This is, in fact, a report that you commissioned, and I will give you a brief overview. If for some reason you haven't seen the actual report, please let me know, or David, and we can get you a copy. I made this presentation or modification of the presentation to the Provost Council. Susan has sat through it once, and it generated some lively conversation. If we had more time, I could fill you in on that. But I'm going to give you the gist of the report. Let's see if this works. These are members of the task force, the Senate Faculty Senate Task Force. Craig Gerlach was the chair, and he carried the ball leadership for most of the way and took another position at Calgary, and the draft needed some revisions, and we worked together and made that happen. But as you can see, there's a wide range of diversity of people who served on the committee. We met several times through the course of last year and into the fall, had more virtual meetings. Just as a way of starting, interdisciplinary is a topic that's kicked around by a lot of folks. It's a term that is sometimes interchanged with transdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, pandisciplinary. This is a definition from the National Academy of Sciences, which did a special study on what is interdisciplinary as education and education and research. And we see a mode of research for learning, of learning and or research undertaken by teams or individuals that integrates information, data, techniques, tools, perspectives, concepts, and or theories from two or more disciplines or bodies of specialized knowledge to advance fundamental understandings or to solve problems whose solutions are beyond the scope of a single discipline or area of research practice. All one sentence. Just to underscore what are some of the key things here, teams or individuals integrates advancing fundamental knowledge. So we can think about interdisciplinary as a basic science, or we can see it as applied, and it generally applies when one discipline can't do it alone. I'm curious, how many of you in this room feel like you are involved or have been involved in interdisciplinary research?
No. I have.
Okay, far out. That's quite a representation. So why should we do it at UAF? Why should we be concerned about this? I think one of the main reasons is that interdisciplinary work allows us to be relevant to real-world problems. It helps us be considered as meaningful to entities like the Alaska Legislature. I think we are poised to become a world leader in interdisciplinary. Arctic studies are inherently, are often interdisciplinary, and what we do here, we could become a leader in that approach, both in research and education. Most of you get the little publication, The Academe, and in this last issue, it was about interdisciplinary framed as educating the new public intellectual. We need a public that looks at problems holistically and can understand the world in some big picture ways. So that was the argument of that particular article. Many of the calls for proposals from National Science Foundation, from NASA, from other places are requiring interdisciplinary approaches, so it's really tied to getting more money to the university. And finally, there's a growing demand from students. Some of you already know this. We were charged with the task by you to ask, how do we create an institutional environment and a culture that will help rather than hinder the progress of interdisciplinary research and education at the University of Alaska Fairbanks? And we were asked to identify problem areas, barriers, constraints, highlight the current efforts at UAF, look at models outside our own university, and make some recommendations for change. As we started into this conversation, we recognized up front that there's a lot of good stuff going on here. There's a long history of interdisciplinary research and education at UAF. Lawrence Irving's early papers on indigenous naming of birds to look at Gwich'in versus Inuit understanding of biological diversity is just one example, and that was done in the early 50s. We have several outstanding interdisciplinary education and research programs happening, and where there's top-level support from our administration. These two folks to my right have expressed their strong support for doing this kind of work and growing student interest. So this is from a graduate school draft report that shows changes in the number of doctoral students, master's students, and total. Doctoral's red here. We see a slight increase. And then this is INDS, PhD students and MAs. The red is the PhDs. So the slope of that is greater than the slope of this. In 2012, 22% of the PhDs awarded by UAF were INDS PhDs. So that's a call. And there's a lot of good stuff happening. As I said, the Honors Program has done interdisciplinary work, Indigenous Studies, the Resilience and Adaptation Program that I was involved with for 10 years, the SUNRAS School of Management, PhD in Natural Resources and Sustainability, and many other groups on campus, SNAP, LTRs, IARC, so on and so forth, EPSCoR, are involved in this work. But still, there's work to be done to improve it because there are problems, there are barriers, there are constraints. We looked outside UAF and we found a number of really interesting examples of how folks are doing it. University of Hawaii has an interdisciplinary cluster hire model of how to bring people in and give them joint appointments. The University of Peking University has an Academy of Advanced Interdisciplinary Studies where all things interdisciplinary are under this umbrella. So they have a place where they can reside, both in research and education. There's the Arizona State University, under the leadership of Michael Crow, has been advocating the New American University, which is a way of making universities relevant and connected to the real world. And President Crow basically bulldozed the disciplines, the silos, and created new problem-based disciplines at that institution. The Stockholm Resilience Center is another one that's doing this work with Swedish money. So to run through some of the barriers and constraints at the institutional and administrative level, the committee found that there are really limited institutional frameworks for these sorts of activities to live at UAF. Students with co-advisors from different units are often only counted by the primary unit. Serving on an interdisciplinary committee is often discouraged. It's sometimes discouraged by department heads and deans. Wait till you're a full professor, and then you can allow yourself to think in these big interdisciplinary ways. Academic unit revenue distribution is based on a system of statewide accounting that doesn't really reward for interdisciplinary efforts. And the overhead from grants by faculty with joint appointments is sometimes disputed. Not always, but in some cases, people are trying to figure out where the money goes because it has to go one place or another place. At the faculty level, there are often disincentives for faculty to engage in interdisciplinary scholarship. Some of that has to do with promotion files and tenure files are evaluated by the rank and file of disciplinarians from a home unit. It is only at the discretion of the deans and directors that if you have a joint appointment that your home academic unit would invite other folks in. I was on the joint appointment committee, and some of that language is being worked out, and that was one of the sticking points, one of the controversial points that we've worked through, and it's the proposal is okay, but it's not perfect. Cross-listed courses count for departments of students irrespective of the instructor's department. So there's some problems if you're teaching an interdisciplinary course, who gets the credit? At the student level, there's limited funding for INDS graduate students. In some cases, there's a privileging of a disciplinary student over an INDS graduate student by some departments. So if I am if I am an INDS PhD student with a biology chair of my committee, and biology is my home, and I apply to do a TA in biology, even if I have a master's in biology, because I'm an INDS student, I will be considered, after all, PhD biology major students are first given TA opportunities. And I don't want to point fingers at that one department. I just know that one is, in fact, the case It happens in a number of places. The requirement that INDS students, in order to get into the program, have to have a fully developed proposal. And that is sometimes a barrier. We don't expect that of our disciplinary-based students. So that's something that was discussed by the committee. So a start at recommendations, and it's hardly the be-all, end-all, and I wish we had more time because you have the solutions, and we need to hear them, is we need to shape the culture, and part of that has to do with revisiting what are the reward systems of our institution, and that is all of our jobs, but I have the Chancellor, Provost, and the administration down here on the hook for helping us do that. We need to review how tenure and promotion happens with respect to interdisciplinary folks and who is evaluating them and to what extent interdisciplinary enterprises or efforts are rewarded and considered and who is actually evaluating them. And that goes to what kind of journals are you in, what kind of work are you doing, so on and so forth. We might want to consider promoting cluster hires or joint appointments with shared faculty workloads and do more of that, including faculty from both appointment areas, not just the academic home, on TMP committees, provide more funding for graduate students who are INDS funded or a way for them to get access to money, and revisit the idea that a full thesis proposal has to be required for an INDS PhD program. So this is some of what was done. Oh, and establish perhaps, and this is a discussion that's going on, establish a faculty of interdisciplinary graduate studies so that those faculty who want to engage in this kind of work will be rewarded. It's seen as legitimate and recognized on their workloads. And it isn't seen as taking away from departmental efforts. So where do we go from here? How do we move from action, barriers to action? Do we need to bulldoze as Arizona State did? Probably not. But there are some things we can do. We need to ask ourselves who's responsible for making the next these sets of recommendations happen, going through rather than just letting the report kind of be out there. Perhaps a task force is necessary. This Wednesday, all INDS undergraduate master's and PhD students are gathering for lunch that the Dean of Graduate Students and I are convening to just talk about what their experience is. And then ask ourselves, what's the timeline for meeting these various requirements? This particular presentation generated a lot of really interesting conversation at the Provost Council. Some folks were saying, we're doing just fine, there's not much needed. Other folks said, yes, there are some changes. And there were a lot of interesting points brought up about from the dean and director's perspective of what they see as issues that I hadn't even considered. So that's my short report.
Thank you very much, Gary. I'm mindful of the time, which means I don't want to necessarily say that there's no discussion, but I would, before anybody does discuss, I want to point out that Cecile and I just conferred, and it seems like this would be a useful thing for us to open up a discussion online for the Faculty Senate at the Senate Google site. So we'll go ahead and do that. What I'm especially interested in is your suggestions with respect to how the Faculty Senate might move on trying to address some of these things. Where's the low-hanging fruit? So so I'll be definitely interested in getting your comments that way.
And just as a reminder, we just received a report from the Joint Appointments Committee, so that'll, I think, be really interesting to kind of look at them side by side and maybe come up with some more specific ideas for how to do both short-term and long-term.
I would invite ideas, innovations beyond what just the Faculty Senate can do, but what anyone anywhere at the institution can do, because once we make a list of those brainstorm ideas, we can sort through them and have conversations with folks. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gary. Okay. Did anybody have anything burning they wanted to ask Dr. Kupinas before he leaves? Okay, great.
Over here.
Oh, right there.
When you say interdisciplinary is a fundamental science, I disagree. I mean, interdisciplinary is built on the combination of fundamental science.
Actually, I'm glad you said that, and that's what I said at the Provost Council. Good interdisciplinary work is built on the backs of good disciplinary work, and one should not be seen as taking away from the other. this it should simply have a place in the constellation of things that we're doing here.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thanks for that clarification.
All right. We have general comments. Jane, it looks like you're eager to say something.
To the Faculty Cafe on Mentoring, which is a week from tomorrow, 1 to 2:30 in the ballroom. And you can attend online as well. So will you please, I gave these around, but will you please share them with your colleagues? Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. We have all the committee reports. Do any committee chairs wish to highlight something really critical? Okay. I declare us adjourned. Thank you very much.